I want to start this lecture on the topic of the disciplined mind by recalling a question that I was asked at the end of 1999. I was asked what did I think had been the greatest invention of the last 2,000 years. You might think for a moment about how you would answer that question. Anyway, the answer I came up with was classical music. This is, of course, Mozart. And I have to say that part of my motivation for coming up with that answer was that I wanted my answer to be quoted. And if I figure if I'd said the wheel or the battery or nuclear weapons or the telescope, many other people would say it as well, but I figured nobody would say classical music, and I was right, so I did get quoted for whatever that means. But there was actually a much better answer to the question, a little bit more esoteric, and that answer is the disciplines, the scholarly disciplines, the academic disciplines, topics like history and science and mathematics and the arts. Those of us who hang around the university often take for granted the disciplines because, after all, it's our daily food. And we forget that, in fact, several thousand years ago, there were no disciplines. There might have been pre- or proto-disciplines, but there was no such thing as history. There was no such thing as biology or physics or mathematics, let alone calculus or topology. Nor was there such a thing as classical music. And, in fact, most of the art forms only developed in the last few years. But they become the furniture of our mind. They're the material with which we think. And once you learn to think historically or scientifically, you can't even remember what it was like to think without having historical or scientific framework. And you forget that, in fact, these were human inventions. And there was nothing in evolution which said we had to invent the calculus or classical music or social history. These were things that human beings like you and me invented over a reasonably finite period of time, and they're really quite remarkable. And I, as an educator, became struck some years ago about how much of education really skirted the disciplines. Oh, sure, every school offers courses in history and chemistry and algebra and so on, but all too often what is presented is information and facts and definitions, but not really the way of thinking that's inherent in discipline, thinking like a historian, thinking like a scientist. And so when I talk about thinking a disciplined way, I mean actually developing those habits of mind, the mental furniture, which characterizes somebody who, when they, say, read about a scientific experiment, the newspapers say to themselves, well, was this properly controlled? What happens if you varied a different factor instead? Did people leap from the data to the conclusion? Those are the questions that happen when you think scientifically. When you think historically, you ask, you know, what's the evidence? What are the documents? Are the documents authentic? Are there other documents which give another account? Were there eyewitnesses? What did they say? That's what it means to think historically. I'm going to argue today that the major purpose of education, certainly a major purpose of education, is to understand disciplines that seek to answer fundamental questions. And the disciplines are inventions which allow us to answer questions like, what's our past? Where do we come from? History is the effort to answer that question. What are we made out of physically? That's a biological question. What's the physical world made out of? That's a world question of physics. How do the sun, the moon, and the stars move? Do we move? Those are questions from physics. Anyway, fundamental questions that humans have asked way into prehistory, way past 2,000 years ago, the disciplines are our best ways to answer these kinds of questions. What makes the disciplines difficult is that the only way you can know whether somebody can think in a disciplined way is if they can use something that they've learned appropriately in a new situation. If you've been taught, say, history or biology, and you've been taught some information and you can spit it back, you may understand, but you may just have a good memory. And in fact, many of us get through school more by having good memories than by understanding anything. But if you can take something you've learned, say about the Civil War or the theory of relativity or plate tectonics or Euclidean geometry. And if you can take what you've learned and apply it appropriately in a new situation, discussion of a civil war in another country, discussion of a new geological discovery, figuring out what's the best way to get from one place to another, if you can draw on what you've learned in your history or science or mathematics to solve a new issue or problem or question, then you're performing your understanding. You really are showing that you have mastered the disciplinary way of thinking. And that's quite elusive. It's not at all something we can take for granted. In my book, The Disciplined Mind, which was published in 1999, and there was a new edition appeared in 2000 with a new afterword, I argued that there are three understandings which are fundamental to education everywhere. And these are very classical. They're understandings of truth and falsity, of beauty and ugliness, of goodness and evil. It goes all the way back to the classical era. When we talk about truth, we talk often about science in the modern era. Our interesting truths are scientific truths, but there's also folk knowledge and there are mathematical truths. So there are various kinds of truths. Beauty, we typically talk about in terms of works of art, but of course there's also beauty in the natural world. I'm not sure there's ugliness in the natural world. There's lots of ugliness in the man-made world, and there are lots of works of art which are ugly or kitsch. If you don't know what kitsch is, next time you go to a hotel room, look at the wall, and you'll probably find the answer to that question. And in the area of beauty, we're interested not just in people's appreciation of beauty, but also whether they can make an object which is beautiful for them and for others. Similarly, the area of goodness and evil, certainly is something everybody needs to learn about, but knowledge of good and evil is not sufficient if you don't act on it. And so how you act in an ethical or moral dilemma is an important part of understanding of good and evil. So that I give as a very, very broad envelope for education is focusing on these topics. And by and large, most of what one learns in a college or a graduate school is about truth and falsity, though hopefully there is some room for the other topics as well. To make this more specific in The Disciplined Mind, I pick three topics: evolution, music of Mozart, and the Holocaust. And I make it even more specific for the purposes of analysis. This is Darwin, who of course, in a miraculous mental feat, put out the theory of evolution, which has survived amazingly well until today, and it is in fact the only scientific theory we have of human or animal origins. There are faith-based accounts, but they are not scientific because they are not open to disproof. Scientific theories are, and Darwin's has withstood efforts to disprove it. The particular example I use, which is one that evolutionists like very much, is called Darwin's finches, because one of the things which Darwin was struck when he traveled around the Galapagos Islands around 1830, was that there were different species of finches across the dozen or so islands that he looked at. And Darwin wondered why. He wondered why in such a small space you would have these different species. And he put forth an interesting proposition, which actually was confirmed just a couple of years ago through DNA analysis, which confirms that there actually are different species, and the species come primarily from what it takes to extract food in the different ecologies of those Galapagos Islands. In the example of beauty, I've already revealed my prejudices for classical music and Mozart. And what I actually do is take a single trio from the first movement of, from the first act of The Marriage of Figaro, and I analyze that trio musicologically as an example of what it means to think in an aesthetic way. And in the case of the Holocaust, which is my example of evil in this century, I focus on a meeting which took place on January 20th, 1942, called the Wannsee Conference. This was a meeting at which all historians agree, all historians except Holocaust deniers, agree that the actual decision to implement the final solution, to begin to systematically murder Jews and other groups, was made. Incidentally, it was made by 14 men, 8 of whom had doctorates at Central European universities, showing that there's no particular correlation between being educated and being ethical, just in case you thought that there was. But what's interesting is there are no documentary records which actually say, from here forth on, we're going to begin to systematically execute these undesirables. And yet, there's enough circumstantial evidence from various kinds of records and who was there and what happened afterwards that people can draw the inference. So it's an interesting historical puzzle, just like Darwin's finches is an interesting scientific puzzle, and this trio in Mozart, which I call the trio of the conflicting agendas, raises all sorts of interesting aesthetic issues. So those are my the three topics that I focus on. And I should say that there's nothing sacrosanct about those topics. You could look at other scientific or aesthetic works of art or historical topics. These are just, as far as I'm concerned, entry points, examples of issues that you would have to probe deeply if you wanted to really understand what it was like to think in a scientific or artistic or historical way. Now, I've spoken about disciplines and I've spoken about understanding, and I've already indicated that when a person understands, he or she doesn't simply parrot back, because if you have a good memory, you can parrot back even if you don't understand. Understanding is a performance. It's something that you do publicly. You do it so you and other people can see whether you can really use that knowledge appropriately in a new situation. If you want to know about whether somebody has mastered something, you give them an unfamiliar topic or question or example and see if they can perform their understanding drawing on their disciplinary expertise. The interesting finding from the point of view of developmental psychology, and we are in this course wearing the hats of developmental psychologists, is that understanding is very difficult to achieve. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is why it's difficult to achieve understanding and what are some of the things we can do to help students get the kind of understanding you need to be a disciplined thinker. What are some of the obstacles to education for understanding? Some of them have to do with the sociology of classrooms, the way in which we actually run our schools. If most of your assessments are short answers, four choices with the fourth one being none of the above, that's not really a good way of knowing whether somebody really understands something. Because after all, in the world, when somebody says to you there's a civil war in Rwanda, how is that like the American Civil War? There's nobody there to give you four choices. You've got to figure out what the choices are. You've got to figure out what's relevant yourself. The text test context we're all familiar with. You're given a textbook or a set of lectures. You're exposed to them and you're asked to spit back what was in the text or what was in the lectures. And again, that could assess understanding, but all too typically it simply tests recall. So it's not a good measure of understanding. A third one, which every teacher knows about, is the correct answer compromise. The correct answer compromise basically goes, this is a difficult question, class, difficult topic. If you don't push me too hard, I won't push you too hard. And that makes it easier for everybody, no tough questions, but of course understanding gets compromised. And so what one likes ideally with understanding is to go into things deeply enough that you don't leave out the most tricky and the most enigmatic parts of the topic. Finally, and again, this is something familiar particularly to people at pre-collegiate education, but to all of us, even at the graduate level, is the pressures for coverage. The belief that no matter what, you've got to get through all the lectures or all through all the textbooks. As we say in Western history, you have to get to Plato, from Plato to NATO in 36 weeks. You can get from Plato to NATO, you can even get from Moses to Monica in 36 weeks. But if you try to do that, you're going to sacrifice understanding because there's no way to go through many, many topics very, very quickly and still get understanding. So if you turn this slide around, we need assessments which are more rounded. We need to go beyond simply mastery of the textbook. We need to not skirt difficult issues when we're presenting topics, and we have to decide, this is the most crucial thing, not to try to cover so much material, not to give in to that old devil of coverage. Now, there's a fifth obstacle, and this is where we get into the heartland of developmental psychology. I call this, whimsically, cognitive Freudianism. Cognition, in the Piagetian frame, holds that as we get older, we learn to think about things differently, and that actually replaces the earlier ways of thinking that we have. And that's called new stage thinking in Piaget, and Kuhnian terms, we would call that a new paradigm for thinking. Now, some people do learn to think about things in a new way. There's no question about it, and we hope that people who take this course will learn to think about things in a new way. But while Piaget had a point, so did Freud. Freud argued, as you know, that the battles we fight as young children, the Oedipal complex, the Electra complex, the struggles we have with siblings and with adults, particularly mother and father, never really leave us. And throughout life, whether it's in love relationships or in work relationships or in relationships with our own kids and grandchildren, we replay a lot of this early muck. It never really gets totally resolved. And when I speak about cognitive Freudianism, what I want to say is that even though Piaget is right about some things, there are an awful lot of ways of thinking, particularly ones which are affectively charged, which are very, very enduring. And so in nearly all of us, in the topics which we haven't studied really carefully, in the topics where we aren't disciplinarians already, there's a five-year-old child, a very young way of thinking, which is still predominant. And I call these conceptions, these early ways of thinking, intuitive conceptions. Intuitive because young children, without any need for a lot of tutelage, tend to arrive in these ways of thinking on their own. And as you'll see, these ways of thinking are deeply antithetical to disciplinary ways of thinking. I mean, let's take theory of life. It really strains credulity to think that human beings have evolved slowly over millions of years and that, in fact, we are quite closely related to chimpanzees and other kinds of primates. That's not an intuitive way of thinking. And one reason for fundamentalism and creationism is people are offended by that way of thinking, even though there's no scientific evidence to suggest that it's wrong. Most kids, when they are 8 years old, are creationists. This doesn't matter. This doesn't depend on whether their family are fundamentalists or practicing biologists. Because around the age of 8 years of age, kids believe that there was a moment of origin, and in that moment of origin, species became what they are today. So it's very much like the biblical account. At a certain historical moment, man was created, parrots were created, beech trees were created, and so on. It's a very natural way of thinking. It just happens to be wrong. Another way of thinking is if it's moving, it's alive. If it's not moving, it's dead. That's a theory of life. It's very intuitive, but, you know, organisms do fall asleep and they can be wakened, and so emotion is not a very reliable clue to whether something is alive or not. Theory of matter. One theory of matter is if you see something, you can break it into small pieces and you can keep breaking it into small pieces, and when you don't see anything anymore, there's nothing left. That's a very intuitive theory of matter. Another intuitive theory of matter is that I have a heavy object in one hand and a light object in the other, and I release them at the same time, the heavier one will fall more rapidly. Since Galileo mounted the Tower of Pisa, we know that's not true. And since Newton revealed the laws of acceleration or discovered the laws of acceleration, we know why it's not true. But it's still intuitive that heavier things fall more rapidly or accelerate more rapidly than lighter things. So that's an intuitive theory of matter. Intuitive theory of mind is that I've got a mind and you've got a mind. If you look like me, then your mind is like mine and you're good. If you look different from me, then your mind is probably different and you are bad. It's a very intuitive theory. Most kids believe it. Most Secretary of States believe it. There's evidence we have that. If we think about American history recently, we always have the bad guy, it's a guy in all cases I can think of the decade, whether it's Fidel Castro or Manuel Noriega or Slobodan Milosevic or Saddam Hussein. There's always some bad guy, and this fits into our theory of mind that people who look different from us are probably evil and we should be involved in a Manichaean struggle with them. Now, what's interesting is kids don't have to take lessons to develop these theories. They develop quite spontaneously. That's why I call them intuitively. Now, if we could simply say to the kids, oh, these theories are wrong, forget about it, life would be easy. But it actually doesn't work that way because of cognitive Freudianism. The ways of thinking which we develop when we're young are amazingly robust, and they're hard to get rid of, and that's why disciplinary thinking is not a natural way of thinking. It's a way which has to be molded and trained and inculcated over significant periods of time. In an earlier book called The Unschooled Mind, I took the various areas of the curriculum, as you see in this overhead, and I indicated what were the difficulties in acquiring those disciplines. I've already given you the intuitive theories, what we call misconceptions, which are so prevalent in the sciences. In every science that's been investigated, we find many, many misconceptions. The smoking gun is really in physics. You can take students who go to really good schools like Johns Hopkins or MIT and who get high grades in physics. And then when you ask them after the class is over to explain, for example, excuse me, what are the forces which operate a coin when you flip the coin, or what will be the trajectory of a pellet which goes through a tube that's shaped like this when it falls out of the tube, or why is this Earth warmer in the summer than it is in the winter? When you ask questions like this, you find out that not only can these students not get the correct answer, but amazingly, they give the same kinds of answers that 5 or 10-year-olds can do, answers which students who never took the course would give. And this shows you the robustness of the misconceptions in the sciences. In mathematics, arithmetic and mathematics, what we have are what we call rigidly applied algorithms. What that basically means is people learn formulas. You subtract, you do such and such. To solve the binomial theorem, you do such and such. And as long as they know they're supposed to subtract to do the binomial theorem, they do fine. But if they forget the algorithm, or they don't know when to apply it, they're completely stuck. And that's because they don't really understand the formalism, and so they're dependent upon a memory of it. What's interesting about good mathematicians is not that they have a terrific memory. Mathematicians' memories are no different than anybody else's. But actually, it's because they understand the formalism, and so when they forget it, they can recreate it because it makes sense to them. Believe me, if I forgot the formalism for the binomial theorem, I'd be finished because I could never derive it on my own. I think I would be able to remember how to subtract again. That's probably because I understood subtraction better than I understood the binomial theorem, but we're not going to test me in either of those today. As far as the other areas of the curriculum, which are sometimes unkindly called the squishy areas, social studies, humanities, arts, and so on, what we have are many scripts and stereotypes. Scripts and stereotypes are extractions of the common features in a number of events. So most kids, by the time they're 4 or 5, have a restaurant script and a go on vacation script and a happy birthday script. And when they have encounter new birthdays or new vacations or new trips to restaurants, they can see in which way these new instances resemble or don't resemble the script. Now, I've mentioned a script which most young kids develop, and that's a script which says the world is composed of good guys and bad guys. And that script is probably overdetermined. Certainly in the West, the kinds of movies we have, so-called cowboys and Indians or Star Wars movie, really highlight this good-bad way of thinking. But the scripts and stereotypes can be found in any sphere of life. They come from daily experience, from stories, from the media, and they're very, very hard to shake. Most of us have a view of what hospitals are like, not from our own experiences there, but from watching ER or other medical shows. Most of us have our views about courts and police from watching television or movies, and not hopefully from having been accused of crimes. And these things are very, very hard to change, even when they're completely in error. So far, the talk could be characterized as a bad news talk. I described the various obstacles toward disciplinary understanding, but what I want to do in the next part of the talk is to talk about some efforts which we and others have made to help people think in a more disciplined way. And as a kind of a guide to that, here are some steps. One is you have to decide what's really important in the discipline, what are some topics and what are some ways of thinking, like the ones I suggested earlier, that are worth investing not a few minutes, but real time. Then you make a decision to spend time on this topic. You commit yourself, what we do call uncovering rather than covering. And then, to link this to a previous talk, how do we take advantage of the fact that we have multiple intelligences to help us understand in the disciplines? And let me say, if it's not evident to everybody, that these ideas are very counter-cyclical. Nowadays, in practically every state in the union, the effort is to provide, is to stuff as much stuff into kids' minds as possible and then see when the test at the end of the year comes out, whether it's the MCAS in Massachusetts or the TAS test in Texas or the MISPAP in Maryland or whatever. Every state except I think Iowa now has a state test. This goes very much against the notion of going deeply into something like evolution and really exploring it in lots and lots of different ways so you get some understanding. So it's a very counter-cyclical view. I happen to think it's the right one, but I'm not under any illusion that it's one that would be victorious in any state legislative poll at the present time. Four allies for disciplinary understanding. The first one is to learn from institutions which have had some success in inculcating disciplinary understanding. The old institution is the apprenticeship. For centuries, people have learned from older people who are more expert, who draw them into a situation, pose problems to them, let them see if they can solve those problems, and if they can, give them the more complicated problems, until eventually you produce what's called a masterwork, which means that you have mastered the discipline well enough that you can teach somebody else. There's a lot for all educators to learn from the traditional practices of apprenticeships. I also believe that the genre of museums for children, children's museums, science museums, hands-on museums, exploratoria, are wonderful places where kids can exercise their understandings because, as Frank Oppenheimer of the Exploratorium once said, nobody flunks museum. You can go as often as you want to a museum. You can spend as much time on an exhibition as you want. You can bring questions from home or from school to the exhibition or vice versa. You can use different symbol systems, different intelligences. And for some reason, which I don't think anybody ever fully anticipated, these museums actually are more consonant with how children nowadays, at least in the West, learn than the standard school with a blackboard, a teacher in front of the room, 30 seats bolted down to the floor. So there's a lot to be learned from apprenticeships in children's museums, not that is hitting kids the way masters hit apprentices or putting a big fountain in front of the school the way they have in front of the museum, but actually trying to see how people learn in those very interestingly sculpted environments. So approach number one, learn from places which have had some success in engendering understanding. The second point goes back to the disciplines I mentioned earlier and the various obstacles that I mentioned. In the case of each obstacle, there is an intervention or antidote which can help to dissolve the obstacle and perhaps engender better understandings. In the case of misconceptions, I have what I call, in a somewhat politically incorrect way, Christopherian encounters, named after Christopher Columbus. You know, in Christopher Columbus' days, most people thought the world was flat. So if you sailed in one direction, either you would sail forever and not get anywhere, or you'd fall off the end. Columbus doubted that, as did other scientifically sophisticated people of the time. And so he thought if you kept sailing, you'd eventually return to where you started out. And in fact, that's happened often enough that most of us now believe the world is round. We followed Christopher Columbus's example. However, simply to tell somebody the world is round doesn't quite do it. When my son Benjamin was 5 years of age, I asked him what was the shape of the world, and he said, it's round. And I said, that's terrific, Benjamin. You don't have a misconception. You can go to MIT. But then I decided to push my luck, and I said, Benjamin, tell me, if the world is round, where are you? He said, oh, that's easy. I'm in the flat part underneath. And of course, you know, you look at the world, it's flat. You aren't going to just take somebody's word for it. I use another example, a New England example. If you ask kids in New England, why do you get warm when you put on a sweater? The kids will say, well, because a sweater has warmth in it. It's very intuitive. You put a sweater on, you feel warmer. So what do you want to do if you want to have a Christopherian encounter? You leave a sweater outside every day, and the first thing in the morning, you have kids touch the sweater. And you find, lo and behold, in the cold of winter, the sweater doesn't feel warm at all. It feels rather like everything else. And you come to see that your misconception, namely that the sweater is a heat-generating device, which in itself raises temperature, is not true. It doesn't give you the right answer, but it makes you think about what is it about your body and insulation and so on, which makes sweaters and jackets and shirts make you feel warmer. So that's what to do with scientific misconceptions. In the case of math, it's very easy to say what the solution is, but unfortunately it's not very easy to achieve. The big terms here I have our exploration of the relevant semantic domain, what I mean is you really got to understand the stuff which led the person to create the formalism. So let's take the relationship between distance, rate, and time, which is a common formula in algebra classes and in basic physics classes. If you forget the formula of the relationship between d, r, and t, you're unlikely to be able to derive it. But if instead a teacher doesn't teach you the formula, but instead gives you all kinds of animate and inanimate objects and asks you to predict which ones will get across the room first and why, and then changes the factors in various ways, then you begin to see, well, the color of the object and the shape are not relevant, but you know, the speed and the rate in which it's going is, and the distance it has to go is relevant, and so on. And you begin to at least to get an intuition for what the formalism might be. And so if you forget it, there's a chance that you can reconstruct it again. In the case of those warm and fuzzy areas of the curriculum where scripts and stereotypes are the disease of the art, the only solution I know of is routinely and regularly to learn to adopt multiple perspectives. If you read about the American Revolutionary War only in American textbooks, it's a tremendously triumphant account. If you read about it in British textbooks and in French textbooks, you get a very different view of the colonials' rebellion or the way of zapping Britain, which was the way you read about it in those European countries. During the Gulf War of a decade ago, in my son Andrew's class in high school, there were actually kids from Israel and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and when he heard them talk, he got a much richer view of what was happening there than simply by watching CNN. I read the op-ed page of the New York Times. What makes the op-ed page of the New York Times good is not that it has William Sapphire or Maureen Dowd or Anthony Lewis or Bob Herbert, but it has all of them. And if you read them regularly, you will get a more differentiated and more pluralistic view of things. You won't have such a stereotypical view. So the point of this overhead is that each of these obstacles to disciplinary understanding can be attacked or punctuated, but not in a one-time trial that someone has to do regularly, just to test the misconceptions, test the stereotypes, see where they're wanting. A third approach to disciplinary understanding is one that was developed at Harvard by a number of people, including Stone Weisky, David Perkins, Vita Peron, and myself. We call it Teaching for Understanding or Education for Understanding. It's a 10-year project which has had a lot of success, not only in this country, but in other countries. It's used primarily in high school and in middle schools, and the effort is to get kids centrally into disciplines by getting them to perform their understandings publicly and penetrating deeply into issues of consequence. And it took us a long time to do this, but we can boil education for understanding down into four principal components. And my strong recommendation is, if you want to read more about this, is to look at Stone Weisky's book, which was on the previous overhead. The key idea, as I said, is that understanding is a performance. And what the question the teachers have to ask themselves and then convey to students is, what would I count as evidence that you've understood something? So if you've been studying evolution and there's been new discovery made about the relationship between birds and dinosaurs or about some long-surviving dinosaur, or somebody says, well, a computer virus is just like a human virus and it evolves in the same way. If you can take your knowledge of biological evolution and apply it to one of these topics, that's a performance of understanding. If you read about the Civil War in Rwanda and you've studied the Civil War in America, or you've studied genocide in the Second World War, and you can apply your understanding of the American Civil War and of genocide and the Holocaust to the Rwandan genocidal efforts between the Hutus and the Tutsis, then that's a performance of understanding. The other three components are, what are the understanding goals? Unless you know what it is that you want students to understand, of course, you can't decide what the performances of understanding are going to be. What are the rich ideas which get students into topics which excite them and make them want to go deeply into Darwin's Finches or the Wannsee Conference or the trio of conflicting agendas? And then finally, assessment, not something that happens once at the end of the year or in Massachusetts every 4 years as part of the MCAS, but rather assessment much more the way it takes place in the arts or in athletics. In the arts and athletics, nobody waits till the end of the year. People know what they need to do. They can watch people who are better violin players or field goal hitters, kickers. They can be helped by coaches, and they can assess themselves, and other people can assess themselves all the time. In an education for understanding, you know what the performances are, and you and other people can all the time say, are your performances getting better? It's a very different way of thinking about learning than you'll pick up if you read the Boston Globe about what the state legislature and the commissioner of education would like to impose. You don't hear much about the disciplines. You don't hear much about understanding. You hear a lot about getting facts straight and knowing lots of geography and things like that. Not bad to know a lot of geography, but the question is why. And the antidote, by the way, to this is the Gardner Palm Pilot, which has every factual bit of information in the Palm Pilot. So if you want to know what the capital of Egypt is or what 10 times 5 is or what the atomic weight is of lead, you simply ask the Palm Pilot and it spits out the answer, and then you can spend time on issues which the Palm Pilot can't help you understand, like what's going on in Rwanda or what's the meaning of the skeleton that's being studied at the University of Chicago Museum. So, three ways of approaching understanding. Learning from institutions, which have had some success. Directly challenging the misconceptions and scripts and stereotypes. Adopting the Harvard approach, education for understanding. And then, the fourth one, using multiple intelligences. And this builds on two ideas which have been important in this course. Number one, that people have many intelligences, many ways of representing the world. And two, understanding is important, but it's not easy to develop new modes of understanding. You remember from earlier discussions the list of the several intelligences. We all have these intelligences, but no two of us have exactly the same blend and mosaic or spectrum of intelligences. And you remember the three specimen cases. And so this leads to the question, if we want kids to understand things like evolution or Mozart or the Holocaust or other nubby, gritty topics, how can we use the fact of our intelligences to help students do that? And my argument, which is laid out in the book, The Disciplined Mind, is there are three principal ways to do this. Through entry points, analogies, and multiple representations of core concepts. I will discuss entry points in a minute. Entry points are different ways into a rich topic. Analogies or metaphors is based on the notion that anything that's unfamiliar to us, we almost have to learn by comparison to something that's more familiar to us. So if you don't know about the Holocaust or about evolution or about quantum mechanics, the best way to learn about it is to compare it to something that you understand better. And multiple intelligences can present you with information from many different domains and with many ways of representing that information, and one or the other metaphor or analogy comparison can help you understand the thing that's more mysterious. If you're interested in the evolution of taste and what teenager isn't, that might help you understand something about the evolution of species, which perhaps not every teenager is equally interested in. Multiple representation of core concepts is tough to talk about. Every idea which we would like students to be able to understand well enough to be able to perform their understanding has a number of key ideas. For example, in the Holocaust, it's the notion of efficient, systematic genocide with careful records designed to eliminate the Jews of Europe and other groups. In the case of evolution, it's the idea of variation, natural selection, survival through reproduction. It doesn't matter once you reproduce whether you survive or not, at least according to evolution. Now, I've said those in words. And you could repeat them and maybe even get them right on a multiple choice test. But each of those is very hard to understand. You might say, what's hard about the Holocaust to understand? Well, it's extremely hard. Large proportions of teenagers, both in America and in other countries, claim they have no understanding of the Holocaust. Many people deny that it happened. Many other people will say, well, it happened only once, happened in Germany, couldn't be repeated. They don't know about Armenia or Rwanda or the ethnic conflicts in Kosovo and Bosnia. The truth about the Holocaust is it's what one set of human beings did to other human beings. And it's happened in the past. It's as old as the Bible, and it's happened since the 1940s. But that's not so intuitive. It's hard to think that we could have been victims or victimizers, and yet that's a primary lesson of the Holocaust. So you can easily see that a cultural literacy approach which says, well, we've spent our 5 minutes in the Holocaust, let's go on to the hologram or the Holy Grail or whatever is next in the book, isn't going to do it. These are tough things to understand. But if you have a multiple intelligences approach, you can capture those key ideas in lots of different ways, and that's really the way to help people understand. Entry points is the simplest idea, so it's the one I'm going to spend the most time on. And that is, if you want kids to understand the kinds of topics I've been talking about, you can approach them in lots of ways which more or less map onto the multiple intelligences. You can approach through stories. There's the story of Darwin, of the finches, of the beagle trip. There's the story of Hitler, of Anne Frank, of the rise of the Nazis. That's one entry point. You can do it through numbers. There are numbers in works of music. There are numbers in the Holocaust. There are numbers of finches and the populations. You can do it through logic. Almost any topic, including the three I've mentioned, can be broken down into a syllogism, a set of reasons. You probably would think that would be most peculiar in the case of Mozart. But in fact, in The Marriage of Figaro, which is the opera that I looked at, there are sets of couples that have to be realigned, and there's only so many ways in which you can do that. And there's also a logic in music. Certain openings require certain closings, but that's logic that's being used in a more metaphoric sense. But anybody with a musical ear knows what ending makes sense and what doesn't if you're composing in a classical mode, as Mozart was. They're what I call existential questions, big questions. My three topics happen to be answers to three very big questions. Where do human beings come from? Evolution is the only scientific answer to that question. What are the wonderful things human beings are capable of? Certainly the music of Mozart is one of them. What are the horrible things that human beings are capable of? Alas, the Holocaust is one of them. Aesthetic, approaching two works of art. Of course, Figaro is a work of art. It's both a play by Beaumarchais and an opera by Mozart and DePonte. But there are aesthetic aspects to everything. You can look at the way that species evolve as a study of shifting morphologies, which are often very beautiful. One doesn't usually think of the Holocaust in terms of works of art, but not only have there been countless plays and novels and poems and works of music, but several of the great movies of the last years, Schindler's List, Life is Beautiful, are based upon the Holocaust. Hands-on, many people, and especially young kids, like to learn by doing stuff. In biology class, we breed Drosophila, we breed fruit flies. Why? So we can watch the traits evolve over many generations, because fruit flies don't live very long and they reproduce very quickly. You wouldn't want to use turtles or elephants because it takes too long for the next generation to appear. And you can use hands-on if you're performing works of art, and there are even things you can do hands-on with reference to the Holocaust. For adults, there's a famous Milgram experiment where ordinary people like us will shock other people at very high levels of voltage just because somebody in white coat tells us the experiment must go on. We might call that Hitler's unwilling executioners. And young kids, when they go to Holocaust museums, are often given photographs of kids who were involved in the Holocaust. And when they leave the museum, they learn what happened to that child. That's a very powerful hands-on kind of lesson. Finally, as has been well documented in recent years, many people like to learn collectively, collaboratively, from group projects where they have to carry out different roles, where they make different jigsaw-style contributions, and that's another very effective entry point. This overhead makes two points. The first one is if you spend time on a topic, you can approach it in lots of different ways. I call it lots of windows into the same room, and that means that you'll reach more kids, because some kids like to learn linguistically, narratively, others through works of art and so on. And sometimes the same person, like you or me, prefers to learn about one thing in one way, another thing another way. So you reach more kids. The other thing is you give students a sense of what it is like to have a disciplined mind. Because an expert, a person with a disciplined mind, a person who can really think historically or scientifically or mathematically, can think about things in lots of different ways, lots of modes of representation. They are not restricted to a single way of thinking about something. Many of us as teachers know the experience when we've been teaching something for 100 years, like I've been teaching multiple intelligences for 100 years, and somebody raises a hand and says, I don't understand it. Could you explain it to me another way? Or even, stop talking. Can you draw this for me, act it out? And if you realize you can't, you realize your own understanding is quite tenuous and needs to be revisited. But think about anything you know really well, yourself, your family, your home, your chosen discipline. You ought to be able to think about it in lots of different ways, and by teaching about something in lots of ways, you just really convey to kids an important lesson, namely what it's like to really understand something well, to be able to think about evolution or genocide or a musical work in many different ways. So that's the four different approaches to educate for understanding as outlined in the Disciplined Mind. Now, in the afterword to the paperback, which just came out in the summer of 2000, I give an explanation of what disciplined understanding is not. And for extra credit, I explain why it's not. This is what it's not. It is not cultural literacy. The crucial point in this cover of E.D. Hirsch's book says includes 5,000 essential names, phrases, dates, and concepts. You could have 5 trillion essential names, etc. It wouldn't bring you any closer to disciplinary understanding. What this is encyclopedic knowledge. It's just knowing lots of stuff. But unless you understand how to put it together and how to use it, if you're thinking in a disciplined way, all that factual knowledge, all that Tom Pollard knowledge, just won't get you anywhere. In fact, it's idiosavant kind of knowledge. It might make you money in a television quiz show, but it won't ever allow you to do work in a disciplined area. Now, this visual, which is more difficult to see than it should be, explains the E.D. Hirsch empiricist view. And I'm picking on E.D. Hirsch, but in fact, I have a lot of respect for what he's done. He just turns out to be a perfect whipping boy because of his epistemology is completely off. The empiricist view of learning, which every kid has, and which most naive adults have as well, which is why E.D. Hirsch's ideas are much more popular than mine, is we're born with a blank slate, a tabula rasa, and the purpose of education is to give us lots of information, and those little Fs, those little facts, which aggregate, and finally, at the end of the day, the person has the most facts, is very educated, and we call this cultural literacy, and it is a naive view of what education is about, but it's very popular among state legislators and others of that ilk. Now, here's the right view. It's the constructivist view, and it's the one we've tried to develop in this course, and it's the one that we owe to Piaget and Dewey, primarily. And that is that when we're very young, we already have an unschooled mind, which has lots of theories, lots of intuitive conceptions, often ones that are very powerful, and I've put those as geometric forms which are filled in. Now, we also have facts, and that's the reason for those little Fs in the second barn. But those Fs don't have any place to go. What we need to do, and here's the tricky part, we've got to get rid of those early theories which are flawed. If the theories are fine, keep them. But when they're flawed, when they're those intuitive theories of mind and matter and life and evolution and so on, which are wrong, we've got to raise them. We've got to get rid of them. And by the second constructivist phrase, we have still a few traces of those early theories. That's the cognitive Freudianism. And we have a lot of free-floating facts, which is kind of where E.D. Hirsch ends up. Now, if you want to try to develop disciplinary thinking. You have to build up the raw materials for thinking historically, scientifically, aesthetically, and so on, and that takes a decade. And it probably begins in middle childhood. And you can see here the new disciplinary structures are emerging. And the wonderful thing, which you can see in 3 and 4, is they provide a home for the individual facts. One of the few real insights I had in the last decade is that facts are disciplinary neutral. If I say to you Napoleon was born, I'm making this up, in 1770, you may say that's a history fact, but it's not. It's no different than if I tell you the Earth is 93 million miles away from the sun, or 2 and 2 is 4, or trio of the conflicting agenda takes 4 minutes. Those things only make sense when they fit into ways of thinking that are aesthetic or historical or scientific or mathematical or whatever. So it's only when you have the disciplinary structures consolidating that the facts have a proper home. Happily, the consolidation does not necessarily result in rigidification or ossification. Rather, the disciplines have semi-permeable membranes. You can connect one discipline to another, and that's what makes multi- or interdisciplinary work possible. And facts can also move from one discipline to another, providing they carry some traces of where they were and providing there's a reason to move them from one discipline to another. This is a very different way of thinking about things. It's difficult. It's not intuitive. But I guess I have to admit that I think it's the right way, and that the E.D. Hirsch naive way that you just put lots of stuff in there and somehow it gets organized and there isn't a lot of stuff you have to get rid of is wrong, even though it's the popular vote. But evolution wasn't very popular for the first century either. Theories are not, you can't evaluate theories and whether they would win a television poll. I want now to move toward the closing part of the talk by making some more remarks about how I think about disciplinary education altogether. And I'm putting this in the context of what do I think of when I think of the K-12 curriculum, kindergarten through 12th grade, what I call a pathway where there is a kind of a concerted and well-orchestrated way of thinking about education all the way through. Enduring questions, big questions. I think that's what motivates curiosity, and education needs to be built around questions that people really care about, existential questions. Mastering the basic literacies. I don't know anybody anywhere who doesn't believe we have to learn how to read and write and calculate. Maybe there are better ways to do it, but everybody realizes that's the foundation. I believe there should be a lot of focus on rich projects, because I think that's what excites kids, and that also provides the most opportunities to perform one's understanding. And the disciplinary skills, methods, findings should be introduced as needed to help us think about these big questions, not because now you're in fifth grade, it's time to do chemistry or medieval history or whatever. Continuing, I think we should learn disciplinary work as much as possible through an apprenticeship, which is why I don't happen to think you can learn disciplines through distance learning. I think you have to work directly with people to learn how to think in these disciplined ways. You've got to keep the questions in mind, the big questions: who are we, where do we come from, what's it all about? And the disciplines should never be seen as ends in themselves. There's an old line that in elementary school we love the kids, in high school we love the subject matter, and in college we love ourselves. But discipline should be seen as the means for answering questions. Similarly, projects and exhibitions should be vehicles where we can show our disciplinary understanding. And disciplinary knowledge should help us answer those questions in a better way. Now, that's a lot of verbiage, and I believe the next slide puts this into charmingly graphic form. We begin with the questions, then we learn literacies, then we learn the disciplines, and only if we've learned disciplines can we think interdisciplinarily. So there's a logical sequence here. However, each of these are means of providing better answers to those questions. Every five-year-old can give you mythic or intuitive answers to the questions of where we come from, but they're not right. It's only if you have literacies, so you can begin to read and make sense of graphs and begin to do science and so on, that you can really acquire disciplinary skills. And as I argued, only if you have disciplinary skills that you can do interdisciplinary work. In fact, this is what I see as the logical sequence. All kids are predisciplinary by definition. We aren't born thinking disciplines, and alas, we can't simply give somebody a pill and say, now you're thinking historically. It's a 10-year process. Then about the age of 8, 9, 10, 11, kids begin to think protodisciplinarily. What that means is they begin to develop some of the ideas which are important for thinking disciplined. For example, that there's a difference between something that happened in the past and something that's imagined. Napoleon lived, Moby Dick didn't, nor did Captain Ahab. 5-year-olds don't understand that. 10-year-olds can, and that's where the difference between history and literature begins to emerge. Similarly, by the time a 10-year-old child is there, the child understands the difference between something in which you can collect evidence and something in which you can't. If Sally says she has a pain, you can't really determine whether that's right or not, because she's reporting a subjective experience. But if, you know, 10 kids have blood spurting out from them, it's a rather lugubrious example, you can assume that they're having pain, and that's something you can collect data on. And that's the difference between science and subjectivity, or things about which you have an opinion. You can say vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate ice cream. That's just an opinion. There's not a scientific fact. But we can say when 1,000 people were polled, 800 of them preferred vanilla ice cream to chocolate, or vice versa, and then you have some data. That's a scientific statement. Only if you have normal disciplinary thinking, which is what we're talking about today, you become capable of the hyphens. The best way to think about that is if somebody said to me that they were bilingual, I would assume they had more than one language. If they didn't have more than one language, I would think it was a foolish assertion that they were bilingual. I don't think you can claim that you can do interdisciplinary work unless you have more than one discipline. This doesn't mean that one can't have interestingly theme-based projects in middle school. In fact, I'm in favor of them. But we shouldn't confuse things that are fun to do and use common sense with things which actually involve more than one discipline. I don't think that kind of work can really be done unless people have at least a working knowledge of more than one discipline. I call that interdisciplinary work. It's different from multidisciplinary, where we say, all right, kids, we're going to do a study of water this year, and first we're going to see what the physicist says about water, and then we're going to read poems about water, and then we're going to read about the Aswan Dam. It's all about water, but it's not really interdisciplinary. It's just one discipline after another. And metadisciplinary is a disease which only people like you and me engage in. We're not talking about the disciplines. That's metadisciplinary. But Mozart didn't spend any time talking about that and was probably better off for it. Moving to summary. We have several modes of representation, several kinds of intelligences. We all have them. That's what makes our minds interesting. But no two of us have exactly the same spectrum, and that makes our minds even more interesting. Disciplinary understanding is tough to get, but as far as I'm concerned, it's really the only reason to send people to school for 15 or 20 years. If you want people to be well-behaved or civil to one another, there are much less expensive ways to do it. If you want people to learn facts, give them the Gardner Palm Pilot. But if you want to learn how to think in a disciplined way, they've got to go to school, as far as I'm concerned. The Tale of the Two Barns. The empiricist tabula rasa is very appealing. It'd be great if that's all that education was about, but I'm afraid that the right answer class is it's much more about constructive architecture, about things we come up with very early in life. They're intuitive and powerful. Sometimes they're wonderful, but often they're wrong, and we can't really think in a disciplined way if we don't understand the importance of control groups, how to make sense of written documents, and things like that. One view of the educational enterprise is learning basic skills and learning facts, and how do we know people have done that? We give them lots of short answer tests. And you know what to do if kids don't do well in tests? You give them more tests. That's the way we find. Sort of like if somebody's sick and you're running a high fever, keeping the fever to see if they'll get better. Another view of the enterprise, which I have neutrally called the better view, says the purpose of education is understanding in the disciplines. And the way to find out whether people are understanding is to give them lots of chance to perform their understandings and to make assessments to truly get at that. And by the way, I would have a very different view of the state tests if they had a lot more choices for people, meaning you don't have to answer this particular question, but here's 10, pick one or two, and here's some ways for you to show me whether you can form your understanding. And some of the tests, I have to say, do have good performance tests in them, but they're mixed up with so many other things that people haven't learned the topics well enough to be able to really perform their understanding in a good way. Two final haunting thoughts. Number one, the disciplines are what separate us from the barbarians. Barbarians have one discipline, that's making war and triumphing, and they're good at that. But when barbarians or totalitarians get in, one of the first things they do is they destroy the books, then they intimidate the disciplinarians, the scholars, and if that doesn't work, they get rid of them. So disciplines are hard-won victories, and they're fragile. They can be easily gotten rid of. I'm reminded of the Hans Christian Andersen story about the beautiful crystal clock. And somebody said, oh, this clock is so brilliant, it's so beautiful, it's so wonderful. It's the most wonderful achievement of all. And then somebody else said, I'll show you something even more wonderful, and took a mallet and smashed it. It's easy to smash the disciplines. It's very hard to build them up, and therefore I consider them very precious. I could even get emotional about them. The other haunting thought is with robotics, with machines and robots as smart or smarter than we are in solving problems for us, and with human genome being essentially decoded and people being able to do genetic engineering, genetic therapy, and changing their minds and changing the minds of their children and so on, I really wonder what's going to happen to the disciplines. It's much too hard a question for me to answer, but I think it's a question worth pondering, and I guess my own hope is whatever we do with robots and with human genome, we'll still have people who can appreciate Mozart, because otherwise they're going to be... We'll still have species that will be able to appreciate Mozart, otherwise they're going to miss out on something very wonderful.